You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
First I was worried that we couldn't tape on Tuesday.
Yes.
Because we couldn't, we wouldn't be able to give fresh Iowa analysis. And then I thought, well, we're going to tape on Thursday. By Thursday, we're going to know what happened in Iowa. And now, of course, it's Thursday, and it looks like we're never really know what's going to happen in Iowa because the New York Times has investigated and are still finding inaccuracies and things. And the actual winner is sort of a coin flip kind of deal. We're going to be arguing in our nursing homes who really won Iowa in 2020. I don't know what your initial reaction was in seeing how things shook out. You've kind of gone back and forth with how you feel about the Democratic Party and how willing you might be to break ranks now that you're a never Trumper, pro impeachment resistance member. How does the Iowa Party look to you? How does the Democratic Party look to you after Iowa?
I think a couple of big takeaways. You're not going to like these, Bill. Trump is winning. I thought the Super Bowl ad was great. I thought his State of the Union speech, although littered with lies, was – and by the way, as a conservative, the idea of, like, giving away, like, scholarships to get votes, doesn't sit well with me. But great TV. I think he's finally doing outreach a little bit, at least, not just fan service. And then the Iowa caucuses, Bill – it's a debacle. You want us to hand over control of our health care to you. You can't even run a caucus. So I think it's horrible for Democrats. I think it's ugly. It's messy. And on top of that, I think Joe Biden, the one guy that you and I think at least, think has the best chance of beating Trump, seems to be in very, very, very bad trouble. So not a good week. If you're a Democrat,
let's just stipulate that how a group of Iowa volunteers run a caucus does not really tell you how a party's president could reform health care. Those things should not be linked. But I get the point.
Yes,
that the average voter might look at what's going on. I mean, not just Iowa specifically, but the fact that this is still a very fractured party with a lot of candidates with. I would say any candidate has decided positives and negatives. We're not really very close to any kind of consensus sense of uplift. And that, I imagine, is contributing to the fact that, at least in the Gallup poll, Trump was on the rise. Now, the average Trump approval number actually is flat. It has not gone up. Gallup may well be an outlier here. But
it really feels, and Bill, I'm giving a speech next week in California, and so I'm putting together, and I've long felt like I could make a compelling argument that Trump cannot be beaten, and I could make a compelling argument that Trump cannot win. But as I'm putting this together, and the same realization hit me, I don't know if you remember, we had our last DMZ before the 2016 election, where I believe I made the argument that Trump could win, and that I didn't think he would, but I was like, this could be very close. I'm starting to have the same thing when I'm putting together these arguments and I'm looking at all the different data. It's looking good for Trump as of today, my friend.
I've always argued that the way Trump wins is through Democratic disunity, and we are not close to Democratic unity at this stage of the game. Now, of course, it's the beginning. Unity might eventually occur. When you can't have, this is the first time a Democratic winner will have won less than a quarter of the initial vote. Now, granted, it's a caucus. The metric is not supposed to be initial vote. It's supposed to be state delegate equivalents. I get that. So this is not something that would asterisk this in record books, for example. But I went back and looked. The only person who has won a primary with I mean, Sanders right now, we've almost 100% in, and he had 24.7% of the initial vote, and Buttigieg was a little over 21%, although, after final alignment and where those precincts were situated, how they translated state delegate equivalents, Buttigieg has a very, very tiny state delegate equivalent lead, although maybe that even might change when the final numbers come in, who knows? Well, my point is that you never had someone win a contest with less than 24.7% of human beings being for that person walking in the door since Scoop Jackson won the Massachusetts primary in 1976 with a little over 22% of the vote. It just illuminates how divided the party is. I mean, Warren got, I think, about 20% of the vote. Forgive me if I'm not remembering correctly. I'll go back and try to look again quickly. But that shows a pretty significant divide on the left side. And then on the moderate side, you have a three-way split between Buttigieg at around 21, Biden around 15, and Klobuchar around 13. And Bloomberg's left there as a wild card, as another moderate person who can make things even more complicated. So what are you going to say?
Let me just put it in context from my standpoint on how bad things are. Bernie possibly won Iowa. Maybe he came in second, maybe he won. Either way, Republicans are saying it was stolen from him. I mean, they're going out of their way to make that point, right? Right now, only 53% of Bernie supporters will definitely vote for the Democratic nominee if it's someone else.
Well, just put a pin on that. That's based on one Emerson poll.
Okay, let me just finish. Then we go to New Hampshire. Bernie's going to win New Hampshire.
Probably.
I don't know about Nevada, but get this. In South Carolina, Joe Biden's supposed firewall. Last time I checked, Bernie's down by 6, and I don't know if you've seen this. There is an effort, a serious effort. I don't think this is a joke. I believe it's a serious effort underway, well, at least somewhat serious, underway to do like an Operation Chaos in South Carolina, where Republicans will vote in the Democratic primary for Bernie. This could get crazy.
I mean, that wouldn't totally shock me.
And then Bloomberg, who I thought Bloomberg was a joke when he first announced this idea. I mean, I think we have to grapple with the realization there is some percentage chance that I don't know what the number is, but it's not a crazy notion that Bloomberg, you know, wins this thing. It's possible.
Well, I can't discount anything at this point, although I think what I think is more probable than that, and I'm not necessarily saying high probability. And by the way, Warren got a little under 19% on first alignment, but not 20. Just double checking that. I mean, I think there's a difference between a Sanders voter and a Warren voter. There's some overlap, but there are people who really, there are Warren voters who do not believe in socialism, and there are Sanders voters who think that Warren is not all that different from an average Democratic establishment candidate. So you can't, it's not a given that if Sanders has the edge over Warren on the left, that he picks up the lion's share of what's left. And between Buttigieg and Biden and Klobuchar, I mean, people thought that Biden dodged a bullet in Iowa at first because the results are murky, but it's very clear that that bullet has hit. He is sinking in New Hampshire polls.
Yeah, I think it would have been, don't you think though, Bill? I mean, don't you think it would have been even worse if it was very clear immediately how badly
sure,
he did?
Worse. It could have been worse.
He didn't dodge a bullet, but he kept it from hitting his heart.
I'm not saying Biden can't recover. I mean, I can see a scenario where that occurs, but he's taken a hit.
Yeah.
He's gone, like, most of the coverage out of Iowa is Biden's bad performance more so than who had the good performance, because it's been unclear who actually won, Buttigieg or Sanders. Although I think there's evidence that Buttigieg has gotten a rise in what New Hampshire polling we have seen. But I don't.
I think you could make an argument that, ironically, that's good for Biden. Like, in other words, if Biden had to do as poorly as he did in Iowa, the worst thing that could happen for Biden would be for someone else to be able to get a bump and coalesce, people to start coalescing around that person. Anyway, crazy theory.
Well, but I had a tweet a while back where there's some people thought that, oh, the Biden people would be happy if Buttigieg won Iowa because they don't think he can win in South Carolina. And I said, I don't think that's necessarily true. Maybe it works out that way. But if he's losing to another moderate who can then claim the moderate lane, that's not good for him. It's an unknown how Buttigieg will fare in South Carolina now, or if someone else can do well in South Carolina now. Maybe Biden holds on to that support. But the one argument why this might be okay for Biden is a Buttigieg moderate distinctly different than a Biden or Klobuchar moderate? The Biden and Klobuchar arguments are much more centered around experience. The Buttigieg moderate is inspired by youthful outsider energy. So there's a different character to the nature of their support. One of the reasons why I think Buttigieg did better in a low turnout Iowa caucus, where enthusiasm and energy have more punch than Biden, who, obviously you contribute to personal performance, you contribute to organization, but all that combined means you need to pull out the lower key, nostalgic Biden voter who's not going to go tromping out in the snow on a Monday night necessarily. Yeah. But does that voter remain in South Carolina for Biden? So since it's not a given that Buttigieg can claim the entirety of the moderate vote, it could still divide over the course of the next several contests, and then Bloomberg comes in. Now, let's say, for example, Biden and Klobuchar both tank. They both get below 15% in Nevada, in New Hampshire and Nevada and South Carolina. Then you might think Buttigieg would have the open moderate lane, but then here comes Bloomberg. So even in the best case scenario for Buttigieg, the Bloomberg wild card is out there, and he can play an experience card over Buttigieg. They're both mayors, but it's a mayor of an 8 million person city versus a 100,000 person city.
And when you get into Super Tuesday, and Bloomberg can drop how many millions? Tens of millions, whatever it takes. And his ads are good. And you can't go door to door on Super Tuesday. It's
That's an air war situation.
Right. And so, you know, I think Bloomberg, as amazed as I am to say this, and if it becomes a stop Bernie, anybody but Bernie effort, which I think, based on what I was talking about earlier, it very well could be Bloomberg versus Bernie.
But again, I have a hard time seeing Bloomberg cleaning up the moderate lane. I mean, this guy has not gone through the vet at all. And there are some basic things that are not going to sit well with a lot of Democrats. You endorsed George W. Bush in 2004. You did stop and frisk. You have a history of sexually inappropriate comments. There was sexual misconduct on your watch in your organization. I mean, that's what we know at this point. What do I not know? So it's not going to be that hard for Buttigieg to say, hey, don't just run over to this guy. That to me, it are the ingredients of a contested convention, which is the kind of thing that always gets mused about, never actually happens. I mean, there are some structural reasons why it's hard to happen, because you have to clear 15% in a congressional district during any delegates at all, and usually a good number of people fall below that, or you're coming very close to that. It's hard to keep fundraising if you're at that point. Things dry up, and you have to quit. But Buttigieg, Bloomberg, Sanders, Warren all have possibly the ability to stay well financed, and I can't totally discount Biden here either. I mean, Biden could pull it out of Nevada.
Do you think Biden's? I'm going to ask the question on everyone's mind. Do you think Biden's done?
I don't think Biden's done. I wouldn't write the obit yet. Nevada is a caucus, but it is a caucus that has had a more moderate bent than the Iowa caucus. Hillary won both 2008 and 2016, although Obama was able to say, I got one more national delegate than you, and made up that result. But she beat Bernie by 5 points in the state delegate equivalents. We don't know the raw totals, but we will this time around. And the culinary union's a bit of a wild card. They don't like single payer. They're a 60,000 person union in Vegas. They endorsed Obama last time. They punted in 2016. Harry Reid indicated to the Times yesterday that they may not endorse this time, which I think would be weird because they have had all the candidates come down and kiss their ring. And so if you're not going to endorse two times in a row, why would candidates come bother talking to you in the future? But they have an incentive to endorse a Stop Bernie candidate because they have an amazing healthcare plan. They don't want to give it up for single payer. Do they go with the Buttigieg? Do they go with Bernie, with Biden? That I don't know. Does Reid put his thumb on the scale in some way? He said he's not going to endorse. Might do something behind the scenes. Don't know. But I don't think it is ludicrous to think that someone could go to the Culinary Union or someone could go to Harry Reid and say, look, you get Biden over the finish line in Nevada, he'll win South Carolina. He'll be back on his feet. He can do well on Super Tuesday. He'll be grateful forever.
Yeah.
He will do whatever you want for him forever. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying it's a scenario that could happen because South Carolina still looks decent for him.
I want to go back. You know, you and Joe Trippi were on my podcast a couple weeks ago debating your column that Iowa may be overrated. Iowa may not matter as much. When it became clear that there was this debacle in Iowa, I immediately tweeted Bill Scheer was right. but if you think of it now, the news about Joe Biden, how do you feel about that column now?
Well, I always argued. I never said Iowa does not matter at all. I never said that. The headline of the piece was Iowa will matter less than ever. And that may still be true, mind you. I mean, it's possible that neither Buttigieg or Sanders is the nominee at the end of all this. We just can't say that yet. And my basic point was, even if the winner of Iowa becomes the nominee, it is not going to be because they just rocket out of Iowa and everything falls into place for them.
But it could be we look back and say that Iowa dealt Joe Biden.
Sure.
Who had been leading in the polls.
Absolutely. And I've always said Iowa has been a winnower and it'll probably be a winnower. And so if it winnows out Biden and Klobuchar and maybe Warren, that doesn't surprise me in the least and is not negated by what I wrote about. I mean, what I wrote about was the candidates themselves were spending less time in Iowa than in years past because.
But if your headline had been the candidates are spending less time in Iowa, nobody would have clicked on it. We wouldn't have done a whole podcast.
Well,
on
you can thank my editors at Politico for that.
Don't hate the player, hate the game, Bill.
But the point is the calendar, the DNC encouraged calendar and the DNC debate rules, which get you on the debate stage, through polling, not just in Iowa, but other places, has made it so the candidates had to do other things, namely travel elsewhere and raise a lot of money to prepare for Super Tuesday and to boost their numbers in polling, that they couldn't just camp out in Iowa. Buttigieg was not in Iowa for the first half of January. Now, he spent a whole lot of time in the second half of January, and I think that obviously helped him. But he also had to go to Texas and Colorado to raise money so he could be prepared for what happens after Iowa.
Right. And I would say that in hindsight, that was probably smart, because if Buttigieg had gone all in and bet all of his chips on Iowa, and then he didn't get the bump because of some stupid app.
Well, even now, lots of people have gotten early bumps without having the money and the institutional resources to build on that. You know, Bill Clinton lost 9 of the first 10 contests.
Amazing.
Iowa was seeded to Harkin, so you can kind of not count that. He was second to Paul Tsongas in New Hampshire. He spun it, calling himself the comeback kid before the results were in. But Tsongas got a good size bump. Now Tsongas, it wasn't that good a bump. He lost Maine and South Dakota to Jerry Brown and Bob Kerry. And then you go on to this sort of mini Super Tuesday, which had seven states. So forgive me. So I was actually Clinton lost 10 of the first 11 because Clinton won Georgia on that day. And that's it. But it was a bigger state. It was a southern state. It came in early. So we got a lot of early news coverage out of it. Songus won the most states that day. Well, a bunch of them were out west. And even at this point, Songus is not that well-financed a candidate. And then comes the real Super Tuesday with more southern states. And Songus is not prepared for it and is also not demographically suited for it. And so Bill Clinton then rolls from that point forward. You know, if Biden was to survive this, it would be because, in large part, there are no other ideal southern candidates in this field. There's nobody from the South and nobody with innate southern appeal, and that is a large part with no innate African-American appeal. Now, Biden could tank, and the black vote, not monolithic, could go in multiple directions. And that would dilute their own electoral strength and the electoral strength of the South. You know, one of the reasons why Dukakis won in 88, you know, that's when the Democrats created a very southern Super Tuesday with the attitude of, we're going to make sure we get a moderate candidate out of this that can compete and not follow the mistake of Jimmy Carter. I mean, he was from the South, but obviously was compromised in 1980, and Walter Mondale from Minnesota. We're going to get a southern moderate out of this. But Al Gore and Jesse Jackson split the South. Gore gets the upper South and Jackson gets the lower South, and Dukakis sneaks in with a plurality of the overall vote. He wins New England. He picks off Texas and Florida. And that's enough to say I'm the most national candidate in the mix. So you might have the South divide this time around, allowing for a Buttigieg or a Sanders to squeak through, or Bloomberg to squeak through.
Right.
Go on.
Bill, we're taping this on Ronald Reagan's birthday, February 6th. Just to help me get this in my head without looking at my calendar, how's the calendar play out? What do I need? When do I need to, like, there are debates, there's town halls, there's
we got a debate tomorrow. Hampshire. There's a debate tomorrow before New Hampshire. New Hampshire's Tuesday. Then you got a week.
Where is that in New Hampshire, I assume?
Yes, yes. So there's a New Hampshire debate. There's a Nevada debate. I believe there's a South Carolina debate.
So debate on Friday. When's New Hampshire?
New Hampshire is Tuesday. If you give me a second, I will look things up for you. But you have a week and a half before the Saturday Nevada caucus.
Saturday.
So Nevada is a Saturday and South Carolina is a Saturday. So the Nevada is the 22nd and South Carolina is the 29th.
Do they realize that my weekends are my safe space? But I don't. I like to do Matt stuff. Not right about.
So we have debates on February 19th in Vegas and February 25th in Charleston, South Carolina. So middle of the week before those contests. And then Super Tuesday is the Tuesday right after South Carolina. So no breathing space. And you have a mix of more upper South than deep South. So you have, for example, you have Alabama. So that Alabama's going to be a similar demographic than South Carolina. Arkansas, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, they're not deep South. They all have some African-American electorate, but not majority. But still, if Biden is holding on to African-American support, he'll be at least competitive in those places. It's not clear to me how well Bernie's going to do in those places. He won Oklahoma last time, though.
Is there any chance, Bill, any chance that Barack Obama comes out and puts his arm around Joe Biden?
I would doubt it. I think there's enormous hesitancy on the part of the party establishment to put their thumb on the scales, because they're all terrified of Bernie-crats bolting. And they may bolt anyway, but they don't add fuel to the fire that said everyone came out to screw what was rightfully his. I mean, very few Congress people have endorsed.
I mean, Trump would egg that on.
I mean, and they already are. I mean, you know, there's one thing that they talk about here. I mean, I don't want to be making excuses for Biden. He made his own mistakes. But to what extent did Trump get his way here? To what extent are Democrats still vulnerable to the seeds of smears being implanted and making them second guess what they otherwise do?
McCarthy went on TV and said that the timing of the impeachment was intentionally meant to screw Bernie so he would be in D.C. and help Pete. Don Jr. tweeted out saying, Bernie effectively won Iowa because, you know, he couldn't campaign there and he still did so well. So they're egging this on. I mean, even Hugh Hewitt said he's voting for Bernie Sanders.
Right, right.
To own the libs. I mean, he didn't say that, but I said that.
But that's clearly what he said. He wanted to have a authentic debate between a socialist and Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, which obviously, you know, a troll.
Be careful what you wish for.
Maybe, but, you know, there is a lot of data to suggest that being an avowed socialist would be an electoral liability. So it's not crazy on Hugh Hewitt's part to try to push for that.
Well, and I think down ballot as well. I mean, not only do they think nominating a socialist would guarantee Trump's reelection, but I think there's also a sense you take back the House.
Or at least, you know, not lose the Senate. I think it's possible Bernie could beat Trump because people just are sick of Trump and they'll take whatever the alternative is.
Remember when everyone thought Trump would be easy to beat?
I mean, who knows? I mean, he might be easy to beat. I mean, we still don't know that.
Nobody knows.
He could be fundamentally damaged and you could put up a potted plant who would still win.
Sure.
But you might then win with weak coattails because it's just an anti-Trump vote. And you're still seen as too far to the left, and people want to check on you as the alternative. So whether that means you lose the House, I mean,
I agree with you, which is to say, I think that there are so many variables that it's playing with fire to try to interfere in game and mess around with. It's playing with matches.
But I don't think what the Trump people are doing is just trying to make it Bernie. They're trying to sow disunity and confusion and bitterness. And I think they're having some success in doing that.
Absolutely.
I think there are some people who have been scared off of Biden's electability argument because they fear Trump's going to wield Hunter Biden like a club. And all the people who lament and say butter emails,
yeah,
that stuff is still working, it appears.
Yep.
And that's not just to say, oh, poor Joe Biden. That's to say, Democrats, you have not learned how to resist these types of underhanded tactics. If they can do it to Hillary and they can do it to Biden, they can do it to anybody else.
Preach it.
That's what hasn't been figured out. How do you just say, look, forget that stuff. I'm not going to let that
I agree. If Biden were a better communicator, he could make – and he's tried a little. But I don't think he's made the point as well as you just did.
Well, but that's a fair point because I've always said part of the electability calculation is show me how good you are at defending the kind of smears that are going to come at you. And if your conclusion is, I don't think Biden did a good job, that's an understandable conclusion to vote for somebody else. But if you're simply reacting to, oh, this smear exists in the world, I'm more comfortable with Bernie or Buttigieg or Warren or Klobuchar, just you wait, because they're going to come for that person too, and you should hope they do it now so you see what happens and you can make an apples to apples comparison about how the candidates deal with these things. Right now, I don't think we have an apples to apples comparison because Biden's got it harder than everybody else.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see what he says about Bernie, what he says about Buttigieg. We kind of know what he's going to say about Bloomberg, but yeah, it's going to be tough.
And he's a professional troll. I think Trump is purposefully elevating Bloomberg. He is next to Biden. The person he's most eager to talk about is Bloomberg. Why would that be when he's not even on the ballot in these states and isn't even, you know, number two or number three in national polling? Disunity. The introduction of Bloomberg in the mix makes it even harder for Democrats to coalesce. And so I have a hard time seeing Bloomberg getting a plurality of votes at any point in this contest, though I can't discount it. Just him getting up to 10 to 15% makes things more convoluted, more bitterness, more conspiracy charges, more likely of a contested convention that doesn't lead to a unified party.
So I assume Bloomberg is not on the ballot through South Carolina. Do you know when?
Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday.
So that's from that point on, he will qualify. Okay.
Maybe there's a state or two where he hasn't, but generally speaking.
The great thing about this podcast, I just ask you stuff that I should know. and that's why I can't quit doing this. Like, even if nobody watched, I would still have to do this call anyway. We might as well make it content.
Now, I live in a lightly populated area of Massachusetts, where you know my city is was heavy Bernie, 2016. It's going to probably go either Bernie or Warren in 2020. My mother, a new Massachusetts resident, got a direct mail piece from Bloomberg.
Wow.
I mean, this is how far and wide Massachusetts is.
If you watch YouTube clips, you can't watch a YouTube video without seeing a Mike Bloomberg ad.
Right.
It's ubiquitous.
Although, I mean, there's a lot. I see a lot of Sanders on my YouTube as well, mind you.
Well, you might have different a different algorithm than I do.
But Massachusetts is a Super Tuesday state. It's not one that Warren has locked, even though she is from here. I haven't seen a poll since October, and even then she was leading, but not by as much as you would expect someone from the state to be. So this is evidence that Bloomberg is planning to compete here amongst other significant states because he has the resources to compete everywhere. And it's not crazy. He could get, 15 to 20 and get a share of delegates out of it, even if he doesn't win. I mean, I don't think Bloomberg is trying to win outright. He probably knows that that is mathematically very challenging, but just getting your share of delegates puts you in contention at a contested convention.
Do you mind if I plug some stuff?
Sure.
All right. So I've really tried to go counter programming a little bit with the podcast. Last week I talked to Steve Young, the Hall of Fame quarterback for the 49ers. The first 10 or 15 minutes we previewed the Super Bowl, which I think is interesting, but now obsolete. But we really got into some cool stuff about his faith and about battles he had with dealing with anxiety, which I really didn't know much about until I was prepping to talk to him. So check that out on Matt Lewis in the News. And then, Bill, I think I teased this last week, but in about 42 minutes, I will be interviewing our friend Bill Buettler.
Right.
The other Bill, William Buettler, who is the only other person I know besides me who has seen every Oscar-nominated movie. So we're going to do the Oscars preview. And I won't tell you what I think is the best movie of the year, but if you go check out the podcast when it's up, you'll know.
I know you just need your plugs, but I did want to ask you before we go.
Yeah.
Your thoughts about the Mitt Romney vote for conviction. Is there real political import to that, or is it just something for the history books?
Well, I think it's for the history books, mainly. You know, it wasn't enough to keep Donald Trump from being acquitted, obviously. I think that from the history books, it's now not a partisan. You can't say it was just a partisan vote. Mm-hmm. I think that Mitt Romney goes down in history as a hero, as a man of character who I think did a very difficult thing. And I think as somebody who needs, I'll just say myself, I need some people to look up to. I need some examples of profiles in courage, that it's refreshing and uplifting to see somebody who did something that went against their own certainly their own short-term self-interest. So I think it was very important, but I think it's more important from a like spiritual legacy aspect than from a short-term political standpoint.
Does it do anything to dull the victory lap that Trump would have liked to have taken from this? You know, so this notion that Trump's done better in polling since this has happened, which again I don't think is quite right. I think it's been stagnant when you look at the averages. If you thought the impeachment was going to sink Trump in the polls, you were wrong. I don't think we can quite say that has helped Trump immeasurably. But nevertheless, he's still at a place. He's, you know, still generally at his high water mark in the averages around 45, which is in theory good enough to win again, depending on where those votes are situated. But does this make it a little harder for Trump to completely spike the football? Because you have a prominent figure getting a lot of attention for saying, look, these charges were true. Use your common sense.
That speech was so good. The speech that Romney gave, if you had a chance to see it, was so well written. Yeah. It laid out the case so logically. Mm-hmm. It was very compelling. Not that that matters, mm-hmm. but it was. Look,
it might matter to some extent. It might at least make you remind yourself, you know what? This is not what I want America to be. It's not what I want a president to be like. And Romney had a pretty, Romney being a Russia hawk clearly influenced that. He was very focused on the fact that you screwed Ukraine. You screwed Ukraine to help yourself politically, in behest to Russia, essentially. To what extent does having that be validated by a Republican help Democrats going forward?
All right. Can I just put a pin in that for 1 second? Yeah. I don't want to dodge it. I want to come back to it. But I want to ask you a question because I'm sincerely interested. So yesterday I had coffee in D.C. with a pretty prominent Christian leader and some other folks. We bumped into a Republican congressman at this coffee who came over and talked to them. And I was around – You know, my wife and I are both part of the conservative movement. Like, I'm around a lot of Trump people. And some of them are people who didn't used to be Trump people, but now they are. Mm-hmm. And it is created that we've talked about what the challenges that this has done for me, like in terms of my identity and the dissonance and the grappling with it, which has been a year, like for years, I've been kind of wrestling with this. My natural state is to want to root for the Republican, you know? I'm just curious, like, do you ever, and this is not a criticism by any means. I mean, you're a liberal commentator. You're not here to provide conservative insight. That's my job. But do you run into people who are like, do you have this thing where you ever hang out with people who are like friends or whatever, but they're Trumpy supporters?
The Trumpy supporters?
Or Trump, that they're Trump supporters, or like, do you ever interact with those folks?
I don't have a raw interaction with Trump people. I know certain people in my community who are Trump voters, but I don't talk politics with them for the most part.
So, I mean, I was just curious about it because like just as recently as yesterday and this person and I had a heart-to-heart about, you know, like the pros and cons of Trump. And the argument, his argument is like, you know, I don't like what he tweets. I don't like what he says. But he's putting points on the board, you know, talking about a culture, you know, talking – even like his rhetoric at the State of the Union was much better too. I mean, it was almost like a speech that Peggy Noonan wrote the speech, and then Stephen Miller broke in and put things about illegal aliens in. But if Trump had talked like that the whole time, which is a big if, but had Trump communicated like that instead of American Carnage, I might even see him differently today. But anyway, to answer your question, I think this takes the shine off of Trump's victory lap by 5 or 10%. Like, I think it's not a, I know it's not a satisfying answer
right.
to you.
No, no, I mean, that's why I'm curious.
I think there's a, I do think there's an impact. He could have completely spiked the football and talked about this being a hoax and a coup and yada, yada, yada. And even Mitt Romney, you know, decide, ultimately, you know,
they were saying the House vote, you know, it was a bipartisan vote to not impeach because you had like two Democrats and one of them who flipped a Republican. And so they really wanted to say it was a bipartisan vote to acquit with Joe Manchin and Doug Jones and Kristen Sinema.
Yeah, but that was plausible. I mean, it was plausible that Romney and Sinema and Doug Jones and Joe Manchin, that they could have all voted to acquit. Like, and it could have been worse than it was. If you like me believe that what Trump did was obviously impeachable.
And you even have a good number of the acquitters saying what he did was terrible.
But he's learned, but I'm sure he'll learn his lesson.
I mean, Susan Collins, man. I mean, look, she's won more statewide elections than me, so perhaps maybe she'll win again. Maybe she knows her state. But I just think that she has played this so poorly.
I heard that she admitted that the notion that he learned his lesson was more of an aspirational like statement or something.
I think there's not just on this. I think there's so many things that she could have done to really burnish her reputation as a true moderate with influence. I mean, going back to Kavanaugh, like she could have banded the other centrists together and forced Trump's hand and demanded he pick someone who was going to be a consensus choice. Instead, she goes up and says, "Oh, I have these concerns about Kavanaugh, but I'm sure he'll respect stare decisis when he gets there."
The story of how Trump does what Trump does is that you have people who enable him along the way.
Right.
Right. And that's part of the story. Like Trump can't. Part of the reason he won't learn his lesson is he's never been held accountable because there's always been people like Collins who enable him.
I mean, there used to be a time when people established their moderate reputations by breaking party ranks in strategically appropriate ways. There's this thing where like Trump's going to learn his lesson. There's, oh, I'm sure Kavanaugh's going to respect stare decisis. And there was the tax vote when she rolled on individual mandate after first blocking the repeal of Obamacare with Murkowski and McCain. She then goes the other way along with Murkowski and McCain. But with the McConnell promised me we'd have this vote.
All right, so
I didn't get it. She sets herself up to be hammered as a patsy, and there's no reason she had to do that.
Here's the point that I heard Jonah Goldberg. I'll drop some names. Jonah Goldberg make on Jamie Weinstein's podcast, but I don't think I don't think he quite put a fine enough point on it. And his point was, I'm paraphrasing, so I don't want to misrepresent him, but my interpretation of Jonah's point was this. People like Susan Collins are squishy moderates. And squishy moderates, the fact that they kind of lack conviction and lack of backbone used to mean that they would be moderate, because that's what was rewarded. That's how they got reelected. Now, people who are wimpy and squishy and lack a backbone go to their base because that's what gets rewarded.
But why would you assume that in Maine? And why is Cory Gardner assuming that in Colorado, which is clearly, you know, a blue state?
Because the argument is, that's what gets rewarded because let's take Maine. In other words, the problem's not Collins, the problem's the system. Okay? She's responding as an ambitious person who lacks a backbone. She is responding rationally to a system. The system used to reward sucking up to independent swing voters and peeling off some Democrats. That's now impossible because of the polarization, right? So there's no scenario where Susan Collins is liberal enough to be better than a Democrat in Maine. Therefore, her only chance of winning is to turn out the entire Republican base and hope for the best. And some of that Republican base, even in Maine, is really Trumpy.
I mean, I know that they're hardcore. I mean, they're Paul LePage Trump Republicans in Maine, but they are not the majority of Maine. You know, Trump won the
Can't afford to lose them, though.
I mean, I get that for primary purposes, but it does that for her. That does not wash for a general election. It is not that Trumpy a state by a long shot.
I don't go to New England. You know, I won't go up there, Bill. I won't even come up for maple season or whatever you guys have. No. So you know the state better than I do, but my thesis is simply that people who are ambitious and lack a backbone are not necessarily stupid. They are responding to incentives. And that's why people like Kevin McCarthy, who used to be an establishment moderate, is now like a hardcore Trump supporter.
I mean, but for almost everybody else I get that with, I don't get it with Collins. But now there's the Tim Alberta argument. Tim Alberta, the Politico magazine journalist.
I like him.
Who basically said, look, I'm paraphrasing, so apologies if I don't get this quite right, but he's basically saying, look, the incentive is to remain in the Republican's good graces, win or lose. That you don't want to be
too
drummed out of, you know, Republican society. If you do lose, you want to have lobbyist jobs or
This was in regards to Lamar Alexander specifically.
Right. Although even in Alberta's argument, which was specific to Alexander, I still don't fully get it because he's 80 years old. I mean, this guy doesn't need a job when he's done. He's just going to retire.
This is why I asked you earlier about if you knew Trump people, because I don't think people fully understand, like, this is part of my identity, and I have to be around all sorts of family and friends who are like, dude, what happened to you? Don't you get it?
Right.
Like, this guy's our guy, man. What are you talking about? Like, I can't get away. These are people I love. These are people I can't avoid. I have to see them all the time. I mean, I had dinner with, I had lunch with my mom and one of her sisters last Saturday. And somehow I was talking about my job and they were like, so do you feel pretty secure? And I said, well, you know, I feel secure, but we're always like one crazy tweet away. You know, every one of us is one crazy tweet away from not having a job. And my aunt said, like Trump. In other words, she was saying Trump sends out these horrible, crazy tweets, which I agree with. And then, but her, like, within the same breath, she was like, did he get out of impeachment yet? And I'm like, well, they're going to have the vote on Wednesday. And she's like, I really hope that he gets out from that. We really need him so much. You know, it was like, there is a, but anyway, the larger, I could go into the details of that, but the larger point for me is, I get what Tim Alberta was saying about Lamar. Like, he's going to go back to a place where probably everyone he knows, like, thinks the right move, the courageous move, the decent move, the Christian move is to support your president. That is peer pressure, man.
Well, and I get that from the left. I mean, it's like people that I live, who are my neighbors, who are my friends, people who I used to work with, people who interact with on Twitter, who know me from years ago. I mean,
you get it from the other angle.
Oh yeah. And that does affect the writing. Now, it hasn't swallow my views, but there's sort of an extra check you put on yourself. Okay. When I get an angry email from my friend, how am I going to defend myself here? Because I know this is probably going to come. So when they say, you know, why are you being just some sort of beltway hack? Why is this just for your job? Is this just to, you know, make a few bucks? I got to be able to defend what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And so I put an extra level of thought saying, making sure I'm not being knee jerk. And I'm actually thinking through my own views. So I get the social pressures one is under, but I also feel like at the end of the day, you got to feel good about your own votes. And this is why Mitt Romney is such an interesting example, because, you know, one person once said to me, you really want in your life FU money so you can, you know, totally do the job that you want to do. Mitt Romney has FU money. Yeah.
I don't want to dismiss the courage. I don't want to downplay the courage of what he did, because they're going to come after him, Bill. I mean, the Utah Republican Party has, like, condemned him. Mike Lee sent out a tweet saying it was very, very wrong, and is basically saying what Mitt Romney did was very
wrong. But I think there's also there are some softer Trump supporters.
Yeah.
In the Mormon community, in the LDS community.
Agree. Romney has the money and he's not up for re-election.
Yeah, I mean, he's in his 70s. He's not up for re-election for several years. I think he'd be 77, 78 at re-election. I doubt he was thinking this is a two-term deal anyway. So I think he's perfectly happy to retire in his late 70s on his big fat pile of money, yeah, knowing that he did the right thing when it was called for.
Well, today I have given Mitt Romney so much shit over the years, but today I'm proud of him. I think what he did was heroic. I'm not even being ironic here. I don't necessarily regret the bad things I said about him in the past, but I'm big enough to admire him today. He's the only out of every Republican, and we can't count Justin Amash anymore because he's not a Republican. Only one did the right thing, Bill. Stunning.
Well, there are people I've said who, you know, you Democrats, don't you feel bad about you said about Mitt Romney? You treat him like he was the worst ogre, and now look what you've sown.
By the way, Tim Alberta, I think, made that point.
But
Josh Krausar.
Look, Mitt Romney was running for president of the United States, and he said self-deportation. He disparaged, you know, the 47%. I mean, he said things that were not good and were subject to legitimate criticism in harsh ways in a presidential election. Now, you could say Harry Reid should have made up something about his taxes. I agree with that. But Mitt Romney said things that were subject to critique legitimately. And some of it's a harsh critique legitimately.
Some of them, but other things like binders full of women overblown.
I mean, and you can say that about any politician or any office at any time. I mean, how many overblown things have been said about Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or Hillary Clinton? I mean, sure, in the heat of a campaign, things get overblown. But that doesn't mean that the entirety of the campaign was somewhat inherently unnecessarily nasty. Mitt Romney said things that deserved rebuke. And as you would probably said in your time, Mitt Romney also switched a lot of positions. He was a chronic flip-flopper, and that's legitimate for critique also. Is he at bottom fundamentally decent in the bigger scheme of things? Sure.
Yeah.
I'm not saying about George W. Bush, but he also launched a war that killed hundreds of thousands of people, so I'm not going to feel bad about criticizing him for that.
You know, I tweeted this out today, Bill, that it's sort of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know? If you really need food and water, you're not going to worry about self-actualization. Look, if I go back to the things I said, the harsh things I said about Mitt Romney in 2008, it's not that I was wrong about them, but I felt secure enough in the future of liberal democracy that I had the luxury of bitching about Mitt Romney being kind of dorky and maybe not having the perfect conservative philosophy. But in the context of 2020, he's a decent guy. And that's all we can ask.
Well, I think that's important. You should be able to criticize people harshly in a functioning democracy. I mean, and we have in this country for over 200 years. Like, that's part of the deal of democracy. I think, unfortunately, and dangerously, the guardrails of our rhetoric have been diminished. And now, and I don't want to boast sides. I'm not saying every person on the left who is dismissive of Democratic norms is a morally equivalent to Trump, but there, it is the case that there are people on the left who are less interested in those Democratic norms. And if we do, if both sides feed each other's illiberal impulses, that's not going to be good for the democracy to continue to function. But I don't think, if you were harsh about Mitt Romney or George Bush, this is all your fault. If you have the ability to remain within the guardrails, just because other people haven't.
I think it's a good place to stop.
All right. So next week, we post New Hampshire. Pre-Nevada, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about.
We never run out. There's so much we didn't even touch today, though.
We didn't touch the Oscars.
No, but well,
so for your podcast.
Check out that podcast. I saw them all. And good stuff.
All right.
Till next week. See you guys.